still got Kurt on the line. We're going to dive back into Paul's treatise, Paul's first letter, the basis of Pauline doctrine, Paul's assault on the Torah, on God himself, Paul's presentation of himself as the lone authority. Paul has already said in this letter, if anybody brings you a message that is different than the one that he is bringing, that he is to be eternally condemned. Now, that's a hell of a risk for you who are Christians, because Yahweh, God himself, brought an entirely different message. So Paul is saying, condemn God. Yahusha brought an entirely different message. You'd have to condemn your Jesus Christ. The disciples brought an entirely different message. You'd have to condemn them too. Of course, Paul did. It's amazing that Christians can't think their way through this, that Paul's claim that anybody that brings a different message, even if it's from heaven itself, they need to be eternally condemned. But that puts Paul and you, Christian, out on a limb that is diseased, that God himself has sawed off. So this is Galatians 1:15 and 16. It reads, but at a point in time, it pleased for God, the one having appointed me, setting me aside out of the womb of my mother, to reveal and disclose the Son of him, in order that I could announce the healing message and beneficial messenger among the races and nations immediately. I did not ask the advice or consult with flesh or blood. Okay, so this is right after Paul is saying that he was the best student of the best Jewish religious teacher. And then he tells you, even though I was a student of the best rabbi, the most scholarly rabbi, whom Yahusha absolutely tore to ribbons, saying they were complete hypocrites, they were a brood of snakes, that Paul claims that he was the best student and was absolutely a perfect example of rabbinical Judaism, and then he says that the same God that this God of his picked him from the womb, which means this God would have had him become a rabbinic student, which means that all of God's statements against rabbinic Judaism are for naught because he sent him to rabbi school. Mm-hmm. What are the odds that that's the case?
Well, zero? There's none, but it's totally logical to make that argument. I mean, why would he send you to a rabbi school if he's going to give you a new beneficial message?
I mean, yeah. Come on. Yeah. Yeah, it's Paul's sitting here contradicting himself, if your eyes are open. He says that he did not ask the advice or consult with flesh and blood. Would that mean that Gamaliel, the teacher that he said he was at the feet of, as he learned rabbinic Judaism and the traditions of his forefathers, does that mean that Gamaliel was a divine creature, that he was a heavenly spirit and that he wasn't flesh and blood? Is that what Paul is saying here?
Well, logically, you'd have to conclude that. I don't think he thought this through.
I don't think he thought this through. Now, I was called while in the womb. There's only one reference to such a thing, being known in the womb. And in this particular case, it's Jeremiah. And it was an entirely different set of circumstances and a different statement. So Paul has twisted something and tried to apply it to himself when it doesn't fit. Because Paul here is readily saying, oh, yeah, man, I was the one that was chosen, and let everybody else be damned. And so, you know, he's going after this. He just can't wait to be the messenger. But it was in Jeremiah's case. Didn't Jeremiah tell us, listen, Yahweh came to me and says, I want you to speak on my behalf to my children, which would be, by the way, every one of Yahweh's messengers speaks to the children of Israel. I want you to speak to children of Israel. But he also says, you know, that with Jeremiah, which is interesting, he would choose him because that's the only one where there's a reference to being known in the womb. that in Yirmiyah, the book is actually written for Gentiles. It's the only one of the prophets that says in its introduction that it was written for Gentiles. Now, in this book, Yirmiyah says that he didn't want to serve as a prophet. Do you find any place where Paul says, I didn't want to serve?
No, he's delighted.
Yeah. Yeah, egotistical all over it. And Yirmiyah is saying this kind of the same kind of approach that Moshe took. You know, Moshe didn't say, I'm too young. Yirmiyah said, I'm too young. But both said, you know, I'm reluctant, and because they didn't feel qualified. And Yahweh told Yirmiyah, said, listen, I know that you feel like you're too young to be a credible witness on my behalf. But, you know, it's not your credibility that matters when you're speaking for me. And besides that, I knew you back in the womb. Did he say that I chose you or I appointed you in the womb, or just I knew you back in the womb?
Well, he's just aware of you.
Right.
He's aware of all of that.
Right. And Yahweh could not have chosen him and appointed him in the womb, because if he did, then free will would not apply.
Yeah, he had to choose it.
Right. You know, he never tells Moshe, I chose you in the womb.
No,
because free will wouldn't apply. So Paul's scenario here is a twist on the presentation that is provided through Yirmiyah. It's just that Paul gets everything wrong.
Well, Paul even says he doesn't have free will, because not only was he struck down and rode to Damascus, but he's also got a demon sticking in his side.
I'd like to just point out something quick, though, and I've talked about this before with you during breaks. He asks these people to do something, but he does know their answer, because he's seen the future. He knows everything that's happening. He knows what's going to happen. So when he's asking these people, he already knows what's going to happen.
Knowing the answer is important. But you have to be really careful in this regard. Yahweh asked Moshe, and Moshe was reluctant and said, I don't want to do this. And in the moment, Yahweh continues to make requests of Moshe. Same thing is true with Yirmiyah. In the moment, which is all that matters in the ordinary flow of time for Moshe and for Yirmiyah, they're given free will. But there would be no reason for Yahweh to go out of his way to introduce himself to someone that he knows is going to reject him. For example, Abraham, at the time Abram, was approached by Yahweh before Abraham knew Yahweh's Torah, knew who Yahweh was, knew anything about him. But do you think that Yahweh asked him to walk away from his country, the first request, and to follow him. Do you think that there would have been any chance that Yahweh would have chosen Abraham in this regard if he knew that Abraham was going to say no?
I'm not trying to say that he's influenced it at all, but on his part, there's free will on the part of the person. Mm-hmm. But on his part, he knows. He's not, like you're pointing out right now, he's not talking to anybody that he doesn't already know.
Right. Doesn't change free will, though. Yeah,
I know.
Free will.
No, they have free will.
So he cannot have appointed, past tense, Paul in the womb, because it would have precluded Paul being able to make the choice.
Well, then, regardless of whether he asked him or not, it would have precluded that. So it's like Calvinism.
Right.
You had no choice. Calvinism means you have no choice.
Correct.
At least
everything is predetermined for you. And that's why it's really important that you understand the nature of what Yahweh knows. And because Yahweh exists unconstrained by time, he knows our future. But knowing our future does not predestine our future.
Well, I've always looked at it like dealing with your kids, dealing with a kid. You may ask a kid a question that you definitely know the answer to, but you still let them figure it out. So he's just asking somebody to do something. He's not coming up to any of these people and saying, you will do this. You have to do this.
Yeah, he's not even saying, I chose you.
He's not saying I chose you. He's not saying any of that. He goes, do this. Can you do
this? I'm giving you an instruction. I'm giving you an invitation. I'm giving you a request. And I'm telling you what I would like and what I would like to see of you. And you get the opportunity to say yes or no. A point eight in the womb does not give free will. Now, I want to tell you, on a 1 to 10 scale of important issues against Paul, Paul's twisting of the Yirmiyah story is a 1 on a 1 to 100 scale of importance in terms of condemning Paul. Having Paul apply this story to himself egotistically from a misstated point of view, now that's important. So it's worth pointing out that Paul is usurping a story about Jeremiah, and he's misapplying the story to himself. That's relevant. Now, the other thing that's interesting here, guys, is that Paul would write his first letter right around 51 CE. Yosha spoke and was recorded by Matanyah beginning in 30 CE and concluding in 33 CE. So we are 21 years, by the time we get to 51, 30 to 51, we're 21 years from the immediacy of Yosha's testimony. 21 years. And we have the witnesses of Matanyah and Yaokanan and the disciples' verbal witnesses, particularly Shimon Kefesh, very prevalent over that 21-year period, beginning immediately in 33 CE. And yet what Paul is saying here is what he wrote is that he was chosen and appointed in the womb to reveal and disclose the Son of Him in order to announce the healing message among the ethnos, the nations, the ethnicities, immediately. It's straight away, forthwith, without hesitation. But wait a minute. 21 years has transpired, and in that 21 years, the Son revealed Himself, as did those He chose. So, Kirk, my friend, if Yosha, contemporaneous with his life and his mission, explained who he was, that he was the living embodiment of the Torah, his affinity for the Torah, the fact that he was Torah observant, the fact that every time he was asked a question about who he is and what he's doing and how someone could know eternal life, pointed them to the Torah prophets and Psalms without exception. If he's doing that and he's speaking clearly in front of people, isn't he revealing the Son immediately?
Absolutely.
And when the disciples, after his fulfillment of the first four mikra, began to speak on his behalf after they're empowered on Shavua, with and enriched with his teaching and the ability to communicate in every language, aren't they now immediately conveying what he said and did and what it means?
And the minute they were empowered, the day they were empowered.
Okay. So that would be immediate, wouldn't it?
This is immediacy.
Now, so Paul, at the time, he was in rabbinic school. Were the rabbis accepting of Yosha and his message?
No, they were. They would like him to go away.
And what did Paul say that he was asked to do at the start of his rise to fame? What made Paul famous?
Persecuting the followers of the way.
There you go. So immediately upon Paul confronting those who had come to know the Son, he harassed them. He killed them.
If he could, you know.
Yeah. And so there is a 0% possibility that this statement that Paul has made, that God chose him in the womb to reveal his Son immediately, straight away, forthwith, without hesitation,
God,
that's
he's
true.
He's kind of slow, don't you think? And he's
yeah.
21
would
years
you, would you think that if God's going to reveal a his Torah and the validity of his Torah in direct opposition to rabbinic Judaism, that straight away is going to include time as in a Jewish rabbinical school?
Hardly. Two things pop up, and one of them is at no time does Yehoshua say, "Oh, by the way, we've completed these four mikras, and you don't have to care about the other three."
Or that that we've completed these four mikra, and you should never pay any attention to them, and you should never pay any attention to any of the things that I've just done.
The whole seven.
Forget the first four that I have fulfilled in your presence. And oh, by the way, don't pay any attention to the next three.
And let's eat some Easter ham. What the hell?
Let's have some Easter ham. Maybe some hot cross buns. And I don't know what we're doing with this Passover thing. But let's come back. And what we're going to do when I return is we're going to celebrate Easter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
Let me ask a second question that comes to mind. If you're a Christian, true, if you're a Christian and you buy this stuff,
uh-huh.
And you understand it. I mean, a lot of us didn't understand it, really, what they were going at, or didn't study hard enough to figure it out.
Yeah.
But if you understood that, why, when you canonize your scripture,
right,
do you not throw out all the apostles?
Yeah.
I mean, Marcion at least was brave enough to say, look, this is Paul.
Right.
This is Luke, and this is Acts. And he threw out everything else. Why did they re-enter those? In fact, my wife has asked this every time. Why didn't they put the damnable evidence back in?
Yeah, what's amazing is if you read Matthew and you set Matthew up against everything else that is written,
mm-hmm.
they're the opposite. I mean, Matthew completely destroys Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
It says that the Torah exists forever. So long as the heavens and earth exist, do not think that that Yosha came to annul it. It talks about the wolf in sheep's clothing that's going to take people away from the Torah and how that is so deadly. It goes on to present that Yosha was Torah observant and that. He came to enable the promises that Yahweh had made in the Torah. And if you read Matthew, you've got to throw away the rest of it because the rest of it is in complete conflict with the opening book. So the moment you add the Matthew to the lot of it, at that point you have to assume that the adherents of Christianity are going to be adherents based upon what they're told, not what they read.
Mm-hmm.
That they're going to be easy to play for fools. That you're going to be able to get them to ignore the obvious, to adhere to this faith.
Right.
Kirk here, familiar with my good friend Don. Don, who has the YHWH-QRA.com site, YHWH-QRA.com site. And Don, ex-Marine, tough as nails, he has family members that are still Christians. He himself used to be an elder amongst the Seventh-day Adventists. And the reason I'm bringing him up is that his approach is really straightforward. He says, read Yosha's most famous public presentation, his longest, earliest, and most important public proclamation. It's called the Sermon on the Mount. Let's call it the Instruction on the Mount. Yeah. And he said, so read Matanyah 5, 6, and 7, where it's presented. And it's presented by an eyewitness. Somebody was actually there. Read that. And then deal with it if you're a Christian. Because what you have to say is either Yosha lied or Paul lied. Either Yosha lied or the religion of Christianity is a complete hoax, because they're the opposite. I mean, there is no correlation. If you were to come up with a list of things to destroy the religion of Christianity, destroy Paul's credibility, and destroy the religion of Christianity, it's the Matanyah 5, 6, and 7. But then it doesn't end there. Because here's Paul's bragging about his affinity with rabbinical Judaism. What is Matanyah 23 all about?
Mm-hmm.
And it is a wholesale condemnation of rabbinic Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to Matanyah 24. We're dealing with the Olivet Discourse, which is Yosha's second longest verbal presentation.
Yeah.
And it's his concluding presentation, the last thing that he really has to say, where he's just saying, I'm going to lay it out for you what's going to happen. And in that presentation, he specifically condemns Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, there's going to be people that say that they have seen me, and they're going to fool even the set apart. And they're going to claim to have seen me in the wilderness. Don't believe them.
Mm-hmm. Pretty clear.
Pretty clear. He says, you know, the next time that I'm seen, everyone in the world's going to see me at the same time, at the same instant. And so when you read the beginning and the end and the middle of Matanyah, and Matanyah's presentation of let's go celebrate Passover.
Mm-hmm.
When you read it.
They kept going back to the temple, too.
Right. Yeah, he was constantly reading from the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Everybody that would question him, go right back to the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, constantly in the temple, constantly sharing from the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, the very things that Paul was annulling. Matanyah, because it focuses on Yosha, his words and deeds, is the antidote for Christianity. It completely destroys the religion. You don't even have to go to the Torah or to the prophets or to the Psalms to recognize that Paul is speaking against Yahweh. Just read the first book of the so-called Christian New Testament, and it's gone. It's over.
Well, you know, Terry came in during the break, and she said the way she grew up as Catholic as a child, and she said the way they got around it was they were taught the missal, which is, you know, like the Talmud in a sense, you know, it's the arguments or priestly comments, the mm-hmm. church thoughts. So they only have to draw out an occasional word from time to time from the from their Bible, just to, and then they usually misquote that or twist it in some way or take it out of context. So, I mean, if you never let them read it, but
right.
Protestants have no excuse.
No.
I had that the whole time. I read right. the very things you're talking about, and
right.
didn't put it all together.
Yeah. And I think it's because of the effectiveness of religion. Religion yeah. is extremely good at being bad.
Yeah,
religious faith precludes the effect of evidence and reason. It renders people who would otherwise be able to think ignorant and irrational.
The only person that it seems to work on, you have to be somewhere inside disturbed by some things.
Yes.
You know, and worry enough that you want to know, or you have to really, I want to know, and I don't care, I just want to know.
I want to know. And
yeah.
and the only way that you get to that point is you have to start either questioning your religion or question religion. You and I both know James down there in Texas, and JB was an agnostic. He was never a Christian, but he wanted to know, even though he knew that religion was whacked out. I mean, he knew that almost everything that was proclaimed in the name of religion was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But he still wanted to know.
Yeah.
And so there's those kinds of people that come to know.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's a lot of secular Jews. The vast majority of Jews are not religious today.
Oh,
the vast majority of Jews, yeah, are agnostics. And they're perfectly positioned because evidence and reason resonate with them. they want to know, and they're not precluded from knowing, from considering evidence and reason by religion. The second group is more like you and me.
Mm-hmm.
We were once religious.
Yeah.
We were active in Christianity. We went to Bible studies. We were once part of this cult of Christianity.
Sure.
And somewhere along the way, for us to have become receptive to what God actually has to say to Yahweh, we had to start questioning our religion. I know that it happened to me over time initially where I just said, oh, God, this, you know, the 6,000-year-old earth thing is just way whacked out. Christmas and Easter are so fraudulent. And I began to recognize that there were a lot of things that just didn't make any sense. And then for me, when I was I began to look at statements like 2 Samuel, where every English Bible says, when he sins, I will not spare the rod, talking about the Messiah. Well, if Yahusha sinned, then he's certainly not making a sacrifice for me. And as I said, so we either have a real problem in that the statements that God's making are untrue, irrational, or we got translation issues. And I began to study it and found out that, oh, God, our English Bibles are just a mess. So you got to, A, be willing to question. And most religious people aren't willing to question because faith is all they have. And if you question faith, it ceases to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And then second, you have to be willing to go where the words lead.
Yeah. And not be afraid. I mean, this is, if you want to know what the truth is, then confront it. And
right.
And you have to say, boy, am I an idiot.
And lots of times. Yeah. How many times have we had to say, oh, boy, did I?
Oh, God.
Oh, boy.
Well, as we go through this study, and which is, you know, we're about a sixth of the way through question Paul, and
yeah.
It's like, Every and I've read this thing, so
right.
Every time I go through it, and you're talking, and whether it's on tape or whether it's when I'm able to be home alive,
uh-huh.
When you're alive, we sit there, and Darren and I will be talking back to each other and say, well, gosh, how can we have been so stupid?
I know. Well,
yes, yeah. It's a broken record after a while, but it's, yeah. How,
yeah, and that's one of there's an area of empathy for both of us as we discuss Paul, because... Well, it's obvious that Paul is lying. I mean, it's just as obvious as the nose on our faces that that everything Paul is saying is untrue. That he's just this egotistical, repulsive idiot that is using, twisted logic and a fabrication of evidence to present his way as being godly. Well, it's painfully obvious and irrefutable that Paul was lying. I was once one of those who bought his rhetoric. And the only thing that I thought that I brought to the party that made me somewhat unique was I really loved evidence and reason. I mean, I'm a guy schooled in rhetoric. I love evidence and reason. I love debate. And
well,
so
I'm a school debater, so your approach hit me,
yeah.
Because I like to go through, okay, well, if that's so, then that, okay.
Right, yes.
I'm not as quick as you are, but if you say it, I can certainly follow along and say, yeah, that's right, or that's right.
Yeah, evidence and reason, logic. It just so appealed to me, and yet this guy fooled me at the area of my own strength. And it was really humiliating for me when I came to understand that Paul was a complete liar. It was just crushing because it was the only thing I thought that I was good at, and he played me for a fool.
Mm-hmm.
And it really bothered me. And so I have some empathy for Christians. You know, I understand how easy it is to be fooled. But I'll also tell you, just as you mentioned here, once someone lays out the ploy that Paul was using. Once someone methodically goes through Paul's statements one at a time and shows you that he is lying, then you have no excuse.
No, I don't, and I agree with you. I don't see how anyone who was brave enough, and it would be brave because you're going against everything they believe in, to read the book and get through anywhere, for the hell, 20 pages, much less where we are now, if you can still say, embrace Paul, embrace Christianity, you got a real problem.
You got a real problem.
Because you know, you have to know.
You have to know.
You can't be that stupid and be able to read this book.
That's correct.
You just cannot.
There is not a single person that has read Questioning Paul from beginning to end, even the first version. The second version is twice as long. Who has remained a devotee of Paul, who has remained a Christian. Not one. It's impossible. Yeah, it is absolutely impossible. And it's not because the book is particularly well written. It's just that the subject matter is so obvious. Yeah, the subject matter is so obvious that this conflict between what God said, what God cares about, what he has done, and what Paul says they're the opposite. Mm-hmm. And the opposites, God would have to be not only a schizophrenic, but he would have to be completely incompetent. Yeah, he is impotent. If Paul's right, the creator of the universe is an impotent boob.
Yeah.
And, I'm quite certain, because I know him, that the creator of the universe is not an impotent boob. So I know Paul's wrong. When I embarked on writing Questioning Paul, it was a request from a good mutual friend of ours, a fellow named Doe DeDavid, lives down in the land of the Kiwis. In fact, a Kiwi fruit farmer. Mm-hmm. And he said that on a Christian radio station that the Christians were bragging about how in the letter to the Galatians, Paul says that the Torah cannot save, and that the Christianity was the religion that grew out of the annulment of the Torah, mm-hmm. with an entirely different plan that was presented by Paul. And he said, if that's true, then the Torah is not only untrue, but it's a waste. It's counterproductive. How can Christians hold that position? So I said, all right, I'll go and I'll analyze Paul's first letter to the Galatians, and I'll find the oldest parchments of it, and I'll go word for word, and somehow the Christians are just somehow misstating Paul's agenda.
Yeah.
And I really tried to view everything from that perspective, and then I came to the place in the letter to the Galatians where Paul says that the covenant that's memorialized in the Torah on Mount Sinai was with Hagar, and that it enslaves. And that is why Paul was promoting a new covenant, a second covenant, that was of the spirit as opposed to of the flesh.
Yes.
Is there any way that you can reconcile Paul's claim that the covenant in the Torah was with Hagar and that it enslaves?
Well, not only can you not, because it says the opposite, but you can't get Hagar down to the down to that mountain down there. So
no, you can't get Hagar there, can you?
Wrong time, wrong place.
Wrong time, wrong place. Yeah, Hagar was the slave of Sarah, Abraham's wife.
Mm-hmm.
And
handmaiden,
handmaiden, and her son with Abraham was Ishmael,
so
and Ishmael and Hagar were both banished. In fact, Abraham was because at 100 he didn't have a kid with Sarah, and so Abraham is saying, why can't just Ishmael be the heir to the covenant, which would be Hagar's son? Yeah, and you're right. God says, no, absolutely not. And so Hagar and Ishmael were banished. They were sent off into the desert, really never to be heard from again. And the only time we really hear about them is Esau went off and married one of Ishmael's daughters. And God says, I hate him for having done that. So that's not, the Ishmael thing, it's gone because Isaac becomes the heir of the covenant. Isaac is Sarah's son, not Hagar's son. And Isaac then gives birth to Jacob, who becomes Yisrael and the father of the 12 tribes. And Yahweh constantly says, I'm affirming my Torah with them. And Yahweh says the purpose of the Torah is to liberate you.
Yeah.
So what Paul wrote is not only untrue, but it's the opposite of the truth.
So if you're a salesman pitching this thing, trying to sell your program, and you are using that, you've got to, you could only talk to people who are non-Jews, non-Yehudim.
Right.
Or non-Jews.
Because you have to talk to, you can only sell this to someone who is ignorant of the Torah. It will only appeal to the ignorant because if you look at Mount Sinai, which is in Arabia, that is the direct result of Yahweh taking his chosen people who were enslaved by Egypt and liberating them from slavery. And that's when the Torah is revealed on Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai, is in the wake of Yahweh freeing his children from slavery. So how can this covenant and the Torah enslave?
And historically, every time they turn to the Torah, they get saved again.
Absolutely.
So, they have this long history of turn to the Torah, get saved, turn to Yah, get saved, go away from him, get slaughtered.
Get slaughtered. And I want to tell you, how many, Bereth is the Hebrew word for covenant. It's based on Be'eth, which is family and home. And it's a family-oriented relationship. How many covenants does Yahweh have?
He only has one.
Right. And are the promised benefits of the covenant, eternal life, perfection, adoption into his family, enrichment, and empowerment?
Yes, sir.
How is that enslavement?
It's a funny kind of enslavement.
Wow. Yeah. So when you look at what Paul wrote, what he wrote is the opposite of what God said. So he's saying that God himself is incompetent of saving and that his very plan enslaves rather than liberates.
Right. Exactly.
I don't think so.